During the last quarter of the 8th century BC, we know that the Assyrians invaded the southwest corner of the kingdom of Judah, basically establishing themselves between Jerusalem, where Hezekiah was reigning, and Egypt, which was a potential ally to King Hezekiah. The Assyrians were fighting against the fortified cities like Lachish and then Libna, and basically making it clear that they wanted Judea to be assimilated into the Assyrian Empire. And Rabshakeh, the military commander, was sent by Sennacherib, who was the royal figure in this invasion, from Libna, or Lachish, to Jerusalem to threaten King Hezekiah into surrendering everything. Now, we have to be honest, it would have been best if King Hezekiah had immediately resorted to the Lord whenever the Assyrians swept into the area, instead of trying to buy them off by paying millions upon millions of dollars worth of gold and silver to them. But he didn't. So we have to just go with the history here. Eventually, Hezekiah got to the point where he did appeal to God by going to the prophet Isaiah. Hezekiah sends his top advisors, who had been speaking to the Rabshakeh, to the prophet to ask for God's guidance. How do we proceed? And so Isaiah chapter 37, which is the story that we're following, there's a parallel in 2 Kings 19 and 20 and in 2 Chronicles 32. But in Isaiah 37 verse 5, it says, "When the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, Isaiah said to them, 'Say to your master, thus says he who is, do not be afraid because of the words that you've heard, with which the young men of the king of Assyria have reviled me.'" See, don't be worried about all their nasty comments and how I'm not going to be able to save you. Verse 7, "Behold, I will put a spirit in him so that he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land. And I will make him fall by the sword in his own land." So God predicts, prophesies, that the Assyrian army is going to soon hightail it out of there because of a rumor that they hear. And that the king, who I think right now is crown prince, the Sennacherib in this story, is eventually going to die violently back in Assyria. So that's a couple of prophecies to be put on the shelf for the moment. Well, verse 8 reports that the Rabshakeh returned because he didn't get done what he was supposed to get done. Basically frighten King Hezekiah into surrendering up Jerusalem and by that all of Judea to the Assyrian Empire. So the Rabshakeh returned and he found the king of Assyria fighting against Libna, for he'd heard that the king had left Lachish. So when the Rabshakeh had been sent out, the fighting was at Lachish. Now it's moved on to Libna. Verse 9. Now comes the rumor. "Now the king heard concerning Taharqah, king of Cush. He has set out to fight against you." Now this Taharqah is a future king of Cush as well, Ethiopia. He is the son of the current king of Ethiopia. And he's carrying on military operations on behalf of his father. Now, there is nothing here that says he actually shows up, just that the rumor is there that he's on his way. And that's all it takes for Sennacherib to panic, because he seemed to have been trying to keep Hezekiah from appealing for assistance from that direction, and he's failed. So now he has to withdraw rather than face a potentially superior fighting force coming out of Egypt. So before he takes off, he tries one more time to frighten Hezekiah into just surrendering. So when he'd heard this rumor that God had prophesied, he sent messengers to Hezekiah saying, "Thus shall you speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah. Don't let your God in whom you trust deceive you by promising that Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands, devoting them to destruction. Shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered them, the nations that my fathers destroyed? Gozan, Haran, Rezeph, the people of Aden, who were in Telassar? Where is the king of Hamat, the king of Arpad, the king of the city of Sepharvaim, the Kivhina, or the king of Ivavah?" So this list, or at least parts of it, have already been put out there by the Rabshakeh when he was trying to convince Hezekiah to surrender earlier, because these are all places that were pretty well fortified, strong, and yet the Assyrians still took them over. So Hezekiah is warned, don't you dare think that you will escape. Your God is no stronger than the gods of these places. Now, there's apparently also a letter that is delivered at this time. Verse 14, Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers, and he read it. And then Hezekiah went up to the house of he who is and spread it before the Lord, or he who is. So the palace of Hezekiah, the palace of Solomon, that's been passed down in this family line, is on the southern end of the what we refer to as the Temple Mount, just south of where the Temple Mount is identified today. And you would go up from that palace to the temple complex. So Hezekiah leaves his palace, goes up the steps, the very dedicated or highly decorated steps that lead from the ancient city of Jerusalem past the royal palace up to the palace of God. And he goes to the temple and he lays this scroll out in front of God. Now, did he go into the holy place? Well, he certainly didn't go into the Holy of Holies. Did he go into the holy place where the priests do their work? Probably not. I think more than likely the closest that he's gotten is probably the porch, the tower on the front that has the two pillars underneath, the place where the king takes his oath before he becomes the king. Probably he goes right up into that area and gets down and rolls this thing out, effectively showing God, look at what they're writing to me. Look at what they're saying about you. Verse 15, Hezekiah prayed to he who is. Oh, he who is of the armies, God of Israel, who is enthroned above the cherubim. Now that's a reference to the Ark of the Covenant, which would be, if he is on the porch, it would be straight ahead of him, through the holy place, into the Holy of Holies. Not very far from him at all. You are the God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You've made heaven and earth. So he acknowledges that there is no real God but God. That he is the one that started everything, and therefore he's in charge. Verse 17, incline your ear, O he who is, and hear. Open your eyes, O he who is, and see. Hear all the words of Sennacherib, which he sent to mock the living God. Truly, O he who is, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their lands, and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they were destroyed. So Hezekiah is really getting back to the heart of his relationship here, where he really does believe there is no God but he who is, that all the other gods and goddesses are fakes, frauds, and wannabes. Their idols are just metal, just substance. And so when the Assyrians make the claim that they have taken over these other countries, even though their gods were supposedly going to help them, and they didn't, and then those gods got burned up, Hezekiah says, but that's not the case with you. You're the real God. You are not represented by anything physical. Verse 20, so now, O he who is our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone are he who is. So let everyone know, by saving us now out of the hands of the Assyrians, that you're the only God. Then Isaiah the son of Amos sent to Hezekiah saying, thus says he who is the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me concerning Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word that the Lord has spoken concerning him. She despises you. She scolds you, the virgin daughter of Zion. She wags her head behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem. So the picture here is of Sennacherib and other Assyrians making fun of Jerusalem and of the kingdom of Judah, because they put their trust in he who is. Verse 23, whom have you mocked and reviled? Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted your eyes to the heights? It's against the Holy One of Israel. By your servants you have mocked the Lord. And you've said, with my many chariots, I've gone up to the heights of the mountain, to the far recesses of Lebanon, to cut down its tallest cedars, its choicest cypresses, to come to its remotest height, in its most fruitful forest. This is, again, a kind of a metaphorical picture where trees are representing countries and kings and ethnic groups. And the Assyrians have gone up into this forest and has cut down all of these trees all over the place and thought that they were in control. Verse 25, I dug wells and drank waters to dry up with the sole of my foot all the streams of Egypt. So bragging that they could even take on Egypt, although it looks like they're kind of running right now from Egypt. Verse 26, have you not heard that I determined it long ago? I planned from days of old what now I bring to pass, that you should make fortified cities crash into heaps of ruins, while their inhabitants, shorn of strength, are dismayed and confounded, and have become like plants of the field and like tender grass, like grass on the hill housetops, blighted before it was grown. So God now says to the Assyrians, look, the only reason any of this is happening at your hands is because I prophesied long ago that I was going to use you to do this stuff, to take down fortified cities and to dry up the populace, just like there were grass on the top of a half-buried house. When the heat comes out, it just shrivels up. Verse 28, I know you're sitting down, you're going out, you're coming in, and you're raging against me, because you have raged against me, and your complacency has come to my ears. I will put my hook in your nose and my bit in your mouth, and I will turn you back on the way by which you came. one of the ways of controlling fierce animals, such as maybe a bull that has a lot of strength and has a tendency to maybe be kind of wild, is put a hook in its nose and pull on that with a rope, and that pain makes it behave itself. And you can take a very strong horse and put a bit in its mouth and make it go this way or that way. And so God says, you guys think you're tough, but you know what? I'm going to put my hook in your nose. I'm going to put my bit in your mouth, and I'm going to wheel you around, and I'm going to send you right back to Assyria. Verse 30. Now comes a prophecy that will help the Judeans and King Hezekiah. This shall be the sign for you. This year, you shall eat what grows of itself, and in the second year, what springs from that. Then, in the third year, sow and reap, and plant vineyards, and eat their fruit. So, effectively, because of the invasion forces, planting has been disrupted. They're not going to be able to plant. They're going to have to first eat what grew last year and then not be able to plant. So they'll have to eat whatever drops to the ground and grows from this crop in the current year. But the third year after that, they're going to do their normal cycle of planting and reaping. Verse 31, and the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of he who is over the armies will do this. So effective, we have a prophecy that everything's going to be worked out by God. And everything will be taken care of. Jerusalem will be protected, just like he's promised before. And there is a hint, though, here that eventually a remnant, a righteous remnant, is going to come out of Jerusalem itself and will be symbolic of God's continued grace and oversight. And that, of course, will take place after the Babylonians come in later and take Judah into exile, and a righteous remnant will come back from that and be the core out of which the messianic story will grow, and Jesus will show up. Verse 33, continuing with the prophecy. Therefore, thus says he who is concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city. So he's not going to enter Jerusalem, or shoot an arrow there, or come before it with a shield, or cast up a siege mount against it. So Sennacherib is not going to have the opportunity to put a siege against Jerusalem. Just not going to happen. He's going to be out of there. Verse 34, by the way that he came, by the same he shall return, and he shall not come into this city, declares he who is, for I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. All right, so we've already got the rumor that has Sennacherib thinking about withdrawing, the rumor that somebody's coming out of Egypt direction, the Cushite king or the Cushite crown prince. And so now God puts another fire underneath the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, to make him get out of there. And so verse 36 says, the angel of he who is went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the people arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. So overnight, in fulfillment to his prophecies to Hezekiah, God dispatches one angel who goes through the Assyrian camp and kills, apparently in their sleep, 185,000 of the soldiers. And when the others wake up and they see all those dead bodies, they decide it is time to go home. Verse 37, then Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived at Nineveh. And so he withdraws from making trouble for Judah. And Judah now is going to be the sole survivor of the Assyrian Empire's march southward. Every other kingdom, every other city-state, all the other ethnic groups have been hit hard by the Assyrians, as God prophesied during this later 8th century BC. But Judah survives. And King Hezekiah is the leader of this kingdom that escaped from the hands of the Assyrians. And that's going to draw attention to him from a group that's been trying to resist the Assyrians for quite some time and have been trying to regain their independence from them, and that would be the Babylonians. And the Babylonians have heard about this, and they also hear about something else that happens right around this same time. So basically, we have about 3 years that pass from the withdrawal of the Assyrian army, because remember, the first year they were eating the crop that was in the field. The second year after that, they ate the volunteer crop that grew up. And then the third year, they actually got back to planting and harvesting. And it was in that third year that this event happens. Isaiah chapter 38, verse 1. In those days, so just right after this whole invasion thing, in those days, Hezekiah became sick and was at the point of death. Now, he actually has some sort of open sore on him. I think it's also described as a boil. It appears to me to be some sort of cancer, which is in the process of killing him. And so God sends Isaiah, who's the big prophet of this time period, to talk to him. Isaiah, the prophet, the son of Amos, came to Hezekiah and said to him, "Thus says he who is, set your house in order, for you shall die, you shall not recover." So the prophet comes with this prognosis. This thing is going to kill you. So you need to make all your arrangements for what's going to happen once you're dead. Now, Hezekiah's response was this. Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and he prayed to He Who Is. So he's in bed because of this thing sapping his strength, making him feel ill. And so he rolls over and faces the wall and prays to God. And this is how he prays. "Please, O He Who Is, remember how I've walked before you in faithfulness and with a whole heart and have done what is good in your sight." So he begs God to think about his record, about how he was the revivalist king at the very beginning, in the first year of his solo reign. And he re-established the covenant at Jerusalem, at the temple. And then how he appealed to God in this most recent event of the Assyrian invasion. And he asked God to intervene on behalf of Israel. And God did. And so Hezekiah says, "I'm your man." And we know from other passages that Hezekiah is described as being the greatest, most righteous of all the kings of Judah. So he is a good man. And so Hezekiah appeals for more time. Hezekiah wept bitterly. And then the word of He Who Is came to Isaiah. And we find out that Isaiah is not even out of the house yet. He hasn't left the palace grounds whenever God speaks to him. That's how quick things turn around here. The word of He Who Is came to Isaiah, "Go, say to Hezekiah, thus says He Who Is, the God of David your father, I have heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. Behold, I will add 15 years to your life. I will deliver you and this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria and will defend this city." So God's response to his prayer for more time is, "I'm going to give you 15 more years. And during those 15 years, Assyria is going to stay away. They're not going to be a problem." And so this becomes a background, I think, to an important book that we're going to go to in not too distant future, the book of Ecclesiastes, because I am of the opinion that the book of Ecclesiastes was written not by King Solomon, but rather by King Hezekiah, and that it represents a midlife crisis journal where Hezekiah is granted 15 more years, and he's excited by that. But then, as he gets to thinking about it, he realizes, I've only got 15 more years. And that makes you start thinking about life and death and how whatever you do doesn't seem to make a lasting impact. And so when we get to the book of Ecclesiastes soon, I will remind you of this event in Hezekiah's life, that he begged for more time and was graciously given it by the God of heaven and earth.